Homes Not Made with Hands, from the Book of Knowledge, edited by Arthur Mee and Holland Thompson, Ph.D. Supposing that all living creatures were gifted with the power of speech, what song might we expect them to sing? If we can fancy such an impossible thing happening at all, may we not imagine that they would sing as their favorite song, that song which is the favorite of every son and daughter of our own country, Home Sweet Home? To many species of animals, their homes are very dear, and they will endure the greatest hardships to defend them. We all know how domesticated animals love their homes. The horse, the dog, and the cat would sing the song with all their might. A horse never forgets the place which has once been its home. One intelligent pony, revisiting a town to which it had not been for 8 years, made a dash for its old stable the moment it saw the house at which its master had formerly lived. A dog will travel hundreds of miles on foot to return to the spot to which the kindness of human beings has accustomed it. A cat so dearly loves its home that it will even remain behind in an empty house when the family goes. And think what wonders of flight the homing pigeon performs in order to return to the loft in which some kind boy or girl has made its home. What, however, of the animals that we have not tamed? They have just as warm an affection for their homes, the dwellings which they have made for themselves and for their little ones. There is a good old English expression, house proud. A woman who is fond of her home and likes to see it pretty and comfortable for everyone in it is house proud. Well, many of the animals are house proud too, and devote great labor and skill to the making of the places in which they live and rear their babies. Seeing that the apes and monkeys rank next in the scale of life to man, we might expect them to show skill next to man's in the making of their homes, but they do not. The larger apes are content with a simple lodging in the trees of the great forest in which they live, and none of the monkeys ever makes any pretense at building a dwelling for itself. Are we to be disappointed at this? Not at all. As we know, man himself, before he became civilized, was content with the rudest dwellings. A rough cave served unto wolves or hyenas came to quarrel over his bones. Man of the very early ages, though he was far superior in intellect to the highest of the animals, never had any home half so snug as that of the mole or beaver. Therefore, let us not think slightingly of the apes and the monkeys because they do not build elaborate dwellings for themselves. The fact is that for the wonders of nature's architects, we have to go to the smaller birds and animals and to the insects. These are the little workers which make us realize how very humbly we ought to view the works of men. Men with their wonderful brains have invented tools for every sort of work. But for all the wonders performed in the animal world, there is not a single tool. We need not step beyond our own garden to see the ants at work. We have only to walk to the nearest meadow to find signs of the labor of the mole, even if the busy and impudent little gentleman does not actually venture upon our private property. Quite a little city under the ground is burrowed by the mole. The mole hills with which we are all familiar are not part of the dwelling at all, so we need not dig down expecting to find Mr. and Mrs. Mole and family at the bottom of one. The mole hills are merely shafts which the mole has thrown up in order to get rid of the loose soil which he has scraped away in making one of his tunnels. The actual home is not so easily found. It is hidden, as a rule, under a tree or large shrub, or in the bank of a field. If we can get a peep inside that, then the mystery of the mole's dwelling is at once made plain. The main hall of the dwelling is a lofty, sphere-shaped apartment. Around the hall run two galleries, one level with the ceiling, the other higher still. The only way into the great hall is from the upper gallery, from which three passages lead through the ceiling. But there are five short passages connecting the upper gallery with the lower. Tunnels run in all directions from the home of the mole, But each one comes out into the lower gallery surrounding the hall, so that the mole, on arriving, must enter the lower gallery, run upstairs, as it were, to the upper gallery, then pop through one of the passages leading into the hall. This, however, is not the only part of the dwelling of the mole. There is a little house for the children. This is a rather large chamber, made where two of the underground main roads or tunnels cross. We can see the reason for this. It affords the parent and her little ones ample chance of escape, should danger threaten. The explanation of all the other passages round about the main hall is not so clear. We all understand that the height of the hall is to give proper ventilation, for even under the ground the mole must have air. For the rest, it is not easy to see why such elaborate defenses should be required. Ferrets and weasels are not likely to go along a mole's run, and there can be no other underground enemies unless it be other moles. That idea suggests an explanation. Moles, when they are in love, are so terribly savage, male against male, of course, that unless some such scheme of defense as we have been studying were made to keep out rivals, father and mother moles would never be able to bring up their families in peace. For like male shrews, the moles fight until one is killed, and very often the victor is so badly injured in the battle that he too must die. The shrew, tiny fellow that he is a great burrower, but not to be compared with the mole. The shrew's abode is a simple nest placed at the end of a straight long tunnel constructed just below the surface. This can be reached easily by any other shrew, but woe betide the intruder. He will certainly be killed if he be a shrew, unless he killed a shrew already in possession. There are connecting links between the shrews and the moles, and we find characteristics common to several different species of these animals. There is a burrowing shrew in India, whose habits closely resemble those of our common moles. There is the desman, which is abundant in the wilds of the Russian Empire, and which once lived in England, an animal whose habits resemble those of our pretty little water shrews. But whereas our furry little creature is content with a mere hole in the bank for his home, the desman makes himself a noble hall at the end of the burrow which leads from his stream. He passes the greater part of his time in the water, but when he comes out to take a nap in his home, his fur is as dry as the feathers of a duck. The fur of these swimming animals never really gets wet. Air collects about each separate hair, and the animal swims in what is practically an envelope of air. Of course, the king of workmen among the animals whose life is divided between the water and the land is the beaver. He must have water in which to swim. He must have a snug, dry home for the night. He comes to a stream which, while of sufficient depth at the time, may in dry weather become too low. So he sets to work and, with his powerful teeth, gnaws at the trunks of trees until the latter fall, then cuts them up into logs, and with these, and with mud and stones and twigs, and all manner of vegetation, builds a sort of wall or dam, as we call it, across the stream. This causes the water to collect at this spot until there is sufficient depth to flow over the top of the dam. There will always be water there unless the stream above the dam actually runs dry. The beaver may now make his home satisfied that there will be at his door the constant stream which he needs. The house which the beaver builds is a masterpiece of skill. It is built of mud, into which are forced branches of trees, and the whole is beaten so solid. When the frosts of winter come, the lodge, as it is called, is as hard as iron. The dwelling is about 6 feet in diameter and 3 feet high. Inside, all is snug and warm, the beds being arranged round the walls, so that father and mother beaver and their family can all be accommodated until the time comes for the little ones to go out into the world to make homes for themselves. Two passages lead from the lodge into the water. One of these is fairly high up, but opens out below the level of the water. The other opens out at a lower point, so that, should the water be frozen at the surface, the beaver can get out by the lower one, to reach the store of bark which it has hidden to be its food supply in the winter. The labors of the beaver are really of an almost unbelievable character. So extensive, so thorough, and so wonderful in design and execution are they. But we must not exhaust our admiration here, for there is another little creature, the web-footed mole, who, though he is web-footed, is not a swimmer, but a landsman all his days, and a miner above all else. This mole makes a home underground, which some of the friends of Alice in Wonderland might envy. The marvel of it is, however, the pace at which this creature works. A reliable observer tells us that he has seen a passage nearly 100 yards in length made by one of these moles in a single night, when the soil has been rendered soft by rain. Now, what does that amount of work mean to a mole? It means this, that if a man were to perform a task equal in proportion to his size, he would have to bore in one night a tunnel big enough to admit his body 37 miles long. Let us remember that when we think that as human beings we do wonderful works. With the beaver in mind, we might expect the otter, a king of the water and a fairly nimble animal on land, to be clever enough to make himself a nice hole in the banks of the rivers which he frequents. But he is like the early men, content with ready-made refuges, and these are in or near the river bank. These he may scrape and shape according to his liking, but it is not known that the otter ever sets out and makes a home for himself where there is not some natural retreat already in existence. The weasels are especially shaped for making their way in narrow, twisting passages underground, but they do not trouble to make homes of this character. They seek shelter above ground. The weasels must be content to share the reflected glory springing from the feet of the big man of their family, the badger. He is a miner of rare ability, scooping out long, winding passages leading to his underground hall, his nursery, and other apartments, which are fashioned upon the most approved plan with regard to ventilation. This is secured by his making 7 or 8 passages, opening 30 paces apart. Each of these passages leaves open a way of escape in case of attack upon the fortress, but each also carries sweet air to the home. Men who know the fox only as an animal which they hunt would scarcely think of looking for their prey in the hole of a badger, but Master Reynold is sometimes found there. It is not because the fox cannot dig a home for himself that he has to seek the shelter of the badger's home. He is cunning enough to turn the badger out of his home and make the place his own. He enters the badger's house, and the big weasel, knowing that he has nothing to fear, permits the intrusion. But while the badger is a very cleanly animal, the fox is not. At any rate, he is not when he takes up his home under the roof of his friend, the badger. So the badger, unable to tolerate the vexatious presence of the uncleanly fox, goes off and makes a new home, leaving the fox in possession. The badger's is not the only home which the fox takes, as the poor rabbit knows to his cost. The European wild rabbit is a splendid excavator. He sinks a steep, sloping shaft into the ground, then, having gone some distance down and forward, burrows in an upward direction, and at the top of this rising shaft makes a big chamber for himself, wife, and family. Sometimes a fox, following a rabbit home, digs his way into the burrow, eats up the poor little rabbit, then, finding the burrow warm and nice, settles there himself. The simple shaft of the rabbit, which we have been thinking of, is not all this animal makes. A few weeks before this story was written, the writer stood in a low-lying field looking up at a bank above which runs a quiet little highway. This bank is simply honeycombed by rabbits who have made their runs right through the bank under the hole of the roadway and into the fields on the other side of the road. But we do not see the entrances to their homes, no. Running right along the foot of the bank, they have excavated a tunnel pierced by scores of little openings. Behind this screen are the openings to the rabbits' castles in the soil. At any alarm, the rabbits bolt to the tunnel, enter by one of the little doorways, then turn to right or left, and gain their homes without the whereabouts of their retreat being discovered. The fox we have been discussing is the English red fox. But we Americans have a gray fox, which makes a snug home in the stump of an old tree. The Arctic fox is more industrious, as it needs to be in the fearful cold of the winter, which it has to endure. To make the best of matters, Arctic foxes recollect in colonies of from 30 to 40 and dig deep burrows in the earth, all the burrows being close together, and in these they defy the cold. But each fox has his separate suite of apartments, so to speak. He digs a main tunnel with a set of rooms and a number of passages at the bottom, and no fox penetrates the estate of his neighbor. Smaller animals work quite as hard as the Arctic fox. The marmot is a little giant of industry and makes two homes every year. He goes up the Alps in the summer and there makes his summer dwelling, which serves for nightly shelter and also for a refuge in time of bad weather. When the early snows of winter come, down the mountains troop in marmots, bringing their little ones with them. When they reach the quarters in which they are to pass the winter, they work in parties of from 15 to 20, digging a long tunnel in the earth, and at the end of that lofty circular room, they carry a large quantity of grass for bedding, blocking the entrance to the home, then go snugly off to sleep for the winter. Other species of marmots are content with one residence for winter and summer, but they are nonetheless busy little builders. The biggest marmot colonies are those in which the prairie marmots, or prairie dogs, as they are sometimes called, reside. Their cleverly made homes are so numerous that they often cover as much as 200 acres of ground. They make excellent tunnels and chambers, and the earth that they excavate remains at the entrance. Or rather, we should say that a dozen entrances to as many burrows are grouped round these mounds, upon which sentinels watching for an enemy take their stand, and sound a sharp tweet, tweet, at the first sign of alarm, sending the whole colony racing down their tunnels. In our own woods, we may find a splendid little builder and our own pretty squirrel. He does not go underground, but makes a nest, which a bird might envy. Either in a hollow or some tree trunk, or in a fork of the branches, high up out of danger's way. First, he makes a strong flooring and sides, and roofs these over with a little dome, all being of twigs so closely woven that the rain and wind, which he hates, cannot enter. The inside he lines with the softest moss, and the little home is as snug as one could imagine. But he must have air, so he leaves open a little doorway by which he enters from below, and has another opening on the opposite side by which he can escape should an enemy seek to attack his house. If rain or wind assails the house, all that he has to do is to plug up the two openings with moss, and there he is, as neatly housed as any little brownie in the storybooks. Two more burrowers we must notice, the echidna and the duckbill, or duck-billed platypus. These are the animals which lay eggs and belong to the strange families of Australasia, where the animals are so different from the animals of the rest of the world. The echidna, which is an anteater, makes his home underground without difficulty, thanks to the enormous power which he possesses in his long and sharp claws. The duckbill, however, though his home is on land, gets his living in the water. Long experience of the natives has taught him to be very cautious, and he selects for his home a quiet stream opening out into reedy, solitary pools in which he can find his food of vegetable matter, shellfish, worms, and so forth. In order that he may gain the water without attracting attention, the duckbill enters from a tunnel which runs down from his home below the surface of the pool. This tunnel winds up through the soil for as much as 50 feet and leads to a big, well-shaped chamber which is lined with grass and is cozy and secure. In order to let in air to the dwelling, the duckbill drives a second tunnel from the sleeping apartment to the surface of the soil, making the opening in the midst of thick vegetation, where it cannot be discovered except by the marvelous eyes of the Australian native. The duckbill has, in this second tunnel, a way of escape should he be attacked from the first tunnel, but he will always take to the water if he can, for with his webbed feet he makes but poor progress on land. We have only just glanced at a few of the clever home builders of the animal world, but even a glance convinces us that in their way these little builders are not to be surpassed among men. The End. Read by Leo Nides for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.